1925 to 1950, an oral history project supported by the Moorhead State University Foundation. This is an oral history interview with Reinhold Utke, April 12, 1983. Interviewer, Bob McLeod. Reiny, tell us when you came to the university.
Quite a few years ago, 1935.
How long were you here?
I was here 4 years, actually about 3 3/4. I started in mid-year and picked up the balance of my credits during summer schools. But I graduated in 39.
1939, mm-hmm. What were your majors?
Well, at that time we could spread out a bit more, I believe, than you can now. I had a major in social studies, a major in music, a minor in French, and a minor in English.
You pretty well ran the gamut there. Why did you come to Moorhead State Teachers College, as it was known then?
Well, perhaps it would be helpful to have me provide a bit of a setting from about my birthplace and about my early education to give you that answer. I went to school at Enderle, North Dakota, at the high school there. Prior to my attendance there, I was in a country school, and our family was interested in music quite a bit at that time, and our superintendent at Enderle knew that and encouraged me to continue my training in music. And he had heard of Dan Preston, who was a prominent faculty member here at Moorhead State, who had developed an Amphion chorus, which had world renown at that time. It was a chorus of made up of male individuals, about 85. And they toured the country quite extensively. I know they went to New York and Chicago. And at that time, that was quite a feat to be able to move out into the musical circles like that. So essentially, that was the initial thing that attracted me to Moorhead State.
Was there any problem coming from Enderle or the rural areas and going to college during that time?
Oh, there were a number of problems. First of all, that was in the 30s, and some people refer to them as the dirty 30s. I know it was a time when money was very scarce. That was one of the problems. But having come from a rural background, probably that was the biggest hurdle that I had to leap over. My dad was born in Germany, and my mother was born in Wisconsin, but both of them had attended no more than about fourth grade in the public schools. And their livelihood was, you know, was farm-oriented. They knew the farm life quite well, but they couldn't quite understand that here a kid from the rural area of North Dakota would want to go to college. That presented a bit of a problem because they had lots of work to do. It was just before the mechanized era, you know, big tractors and big combines, and children were very important in the farm economy, and so there was a bit of problem there. There was some tension in that respect. Of course, they weren't able to help me financially, so I had to kind of strike out on my own and scratch away and do what I could to get enough money to at least take care of the tuition. I had quite a reserve, of course. I was very frugal, and I came with $55 in my total assets at that time. So that was the setting for my beginning college at Moorhead State, which incidentally was not at the regular time. This was started in the winter quarter, which made another problem for me, but it was one that I met and I handled.
What were the tuition rates at that time? Do you remember?
Yeah, $17 a quarter for a regular load of maybe 15 units, 16 units.
$17 a quarter, mm-hmm. for a full load. Incidentally, right now our tuition is $17 and 35 cents for one quarter hour, for 1 hour. And the legislature is talking about raising that to $24.
Well, I might just add in that connection that low-cost tuition certainly made the difference in my having a college education. My parents had sort of groomed me for the ministry, you know how that goes, and that, of course, would have meant going to St. Olaf or Concordia or some college like that, which would have been fine, but there was no way that we could have found money to pay for any higher tuition than this. So I'm sure that that low tuition at that time made it possible for me to attend college, which I very much wanted to do.
During that period when you came here, what did you have to eat? I guess I'd leave it there. What did you eat?
Well, I knew that as I came here, I'd have to do most of my own cooking and scratching to get whatever I could to sustain myself. Only recently have I again started to eat oatmeal, because that was my mainstay for many, many years when I was in school here. And there were a lot of other kids who had a similar diet, but oatmeal had a lot of energy, it was cheap, and we could prepare it on a little gas burner or rent it someplace. A lot of us did our own cooking. So number one, oatmeal. Number two, tomato soup. And the variation was not very great. I'm sure our diet was not very balanced, but we took what we needed, what we could afford, and what would provide us with energy to take care of the job that we had.
Where did you live when you were going to school here?
407 11th Street. Mrs. Walker had a room in her house. She was a widow. And I can recall coming up here to Dr. Lura, and he said, well, there's a room up there, and you can get it for $5 a month. And I was happy to have that. It was a good place.
Did you prepare food then in the room?
No, I made arrangements with one of my classmates to go across the street, down in the basement of the house across the street, and I paid a little rent for that privilege and that service. Can't remember, probably $2-3 a month for that.
Well, so for all three meals a day, then you'd go across the street, cook your oatmeal, and eat your tomato soup.
Essentially, that was it, yes.
Okay. What kind of clothing did the students wear at that time?
Well, anything that would keep them warm, that was inexpensive and serviceable. Most of us had sweatshirts. And this wasn't only the men, the gals had that too. And there wasn't much variety. It was pretty basic gray and denims or very, very utilitarian type of clothing.
Were there times when you might have a dress-up affair?
Yes, for social events.
What kind of social events?
Oh, we had great ones then. You see, we were all pretty much living close to the belt, but we did try to have about four or five functions a year that would allow us to get out of our mundane role, and we'd have, especially the fraternities and sororities, we might talk about that too a little bit, but they had, I believe, class type of social events. Probably would rent one of the rooms at the armory and have a band come in, and these guys and gals would have formal dancing, that is, and they'd have a formal program. You'd sign up Mary and her dance would be number one and number two and for someone else, and they had their best attire at that time. It was really something that all the kids looked forward to, because that was such a contrast to the ordinary everyday activity in life. And then after that, of course, it was a highlight. One of another highlights of it would be to go out and perhaps go to a restaurant and even spend up to 50 cents for a snack or coffee or whatever we had at that time.
You mentioned the fraternities and sororities. Could you tell me a little more about them?
Yeah, I think one of the things that set the faculty apart at that time was their close identification with the fraternities and sororities. They really spent a lot of time developing quality there. They were non-directive type of people, but their presence was always felt, and their counsel was certainly important. And it was one of the things that has really gave kids an opportunity to develop closer contacts, closer friendships. I know in my own case, the people that I knew in the fraternity I was at was in were the ones that really continue to be my friends, and we saw each other, and we still see each other, a number of us do. So I think that was a special type of an experience that most people enjoyed at that time.
How many fraternities and sororities did we have on campus at that time?
Oh boy, about only two men's fraternities, that is social fraternities, the OWLS and the AEs. Mm-hmm. There were some musical fraternities. There were about four or five girls' fraternities, social fraternities, but there were a lot of other organizations at that time that, in addition to the social groups like Geography Club and Math Club and Old Dramatics Club and the journalistic group, I forget all the titles at this moment, but there were outlets for them, for most people at that time, in addition to the athletic activities and the musical groups that existed at that time.
Which fraternity did you belong to?
I belonged to the AEs.
Where did they hold their meetings?
Well, we held our meetings in classrooms and in homes until we had permission to build a room downstairs under McLean. And we did that all ourselves. As I recall, we built a brick wall and gave the interior a treatment of some kind, and we had all of our meetings down there, and that was with the full support of the administration and the faculty advisors, and we were pretty important. We had our own place.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
You mentioned the faculty being close to the fraternity. Who was the fraternity advisor at that time?
Well, Byron Murray was one who was, of course, active in many areas. Schwendemann, the geography teacher. There were others, but those, and Christensen, Arnold Christensen, I believe that's his first name. He was in the education department and director of the band. So he served in many capacities, wore a lot of hats.
And these people would participate then in the fraternity meetings and
they would
functions of various sorts.
Exactly, as advisors, and they were genuinely interested in, and I think helped attract even better quality students because of those extra activities that were present.
During this period, you mentioned that you came without much money, $55. How did you support yourself when you were here?
There were three sets of initials that I recall, MSTC, NYA, and CCC, Morehead State Teachers College at that time. Of course, they had something to offer for me in a general sense, but NYA was a new National Youth Administration, which provided work for people who couldn't hack it themselves, and that was one of the programs that I was identified with. And I did work as a custodian assistant over at Weld Hall.
Was that in the NYA program?
That was in the NYA program. And then I can recall, I mentioned CCC because my brother, who didn't go to high school but did go to the, what was it, the Civil Conservation Corps or Civilian Conservation
Civilian,
Corps?
Right. Mm-hmm.
At that time was a program that, a general program in the nation that helped people to gain some experience and have employment on a limited basis. Well, anyway, I can recall one time approaching new semester time, and I didn't have enough money to pay that $17. I had about $8, but I didn't know how I'd come up with the rest. But about the day before payment was necessary, I got a letter in the mail, and the only time I ever got some financial support from the outside was my brother in the CCC sent me $10, and that kept me on the road, and I was able to continue school.
You mentioned that you received some general help from MSTC, and I was wondering what that would be.
What I mean by that was they provided me an opportunity to go to school. I had a chance to, through Dan Preston, I was able to be encouraged to find a spot that I could probably afford. And, of course, through the many counseling assists that I had from people like Dan Preston, but particularly Dr. Lura. He was the dean of men at that time, and he was just a super guy and a super teacher. I can recall one particular time when I was down, probably about the time, just about a day or so before my brother sent those $10, because I was really pressed for ways to solve my problems. And I can recall going into him and I said, I'm really kind of low today. I don't know which way to turn. I might have to drop out of school. It sure would help if my parents would at least give me moral support and encourage me in my quest here. But I'm just kind of on my own, and I'm kind of down in the mouth today. And he reminded me, he says, well, remember, don't be too hard on your parents. They've gone to fourth grade. Here you are at a college. They just don't comprehend, and don't be critical of them if they don't comprehend what you're about to, you know, what you're trying to do. They don't understand. So just put your emphasis on some other place, because they can't help you, and I'm sure if they understood, they would. But right now, you have to kind of work this out by yourselves. Well, that was a great bit of counseling for me, because I didn't feel sorry for myself anymore. I just went at the job, and I made it.
Oh, you mentioned your parents and Enderlin. When you'd go back home to Enderlin, first of all, how often did you manage to go back home?
Not very often, because my jobs here were often Saturdays when the rooms had to be cleaned. Sometimes there were conventions here in the buildings, and the Weld Hall was used for that purpose, and that meant in the afternoon we'd have to get the place ready for Monday morning. And then the last 2 years I was fortunate enough to get a real big paying job. At that time I sang, I sang fairly well, I suppose, at least well enough to be hired by one of the churches in Fargo. And would you believe it, I got $5 a Sunday for that, for singing there. And that really made me wealthy enough so that I could occasionally eat at the dorm or have a snack downtown.
Do you remember what it cost to eat at the dorm then?
No, I don't.
When you would go back to Enderlin, how would you travel to get there?
By bus.
Would it go, through Wapton and where was
no,
there a bus street?
No, through Castleton and Kindred in that area. Mm-hmm.
When you got back there, what was the reaction of the townspeople about somebody going to college? I'd imagine there weren't that many going to college.
They weren't. I was sort of a maverick. I don't think anybody from that area went to college, at least to Minnesota. There were a few who had gone to Valley City and to Ellendale, but I was kind of breaking a tradition there. And I guess they were kind of happy. They were proud. That here's somebody who's kind of even against maybe family wishes has done this because he wanted to get a more education.
You've mentioned Dr. Lura and some of the other faculty of this period. Would you care to chat a little about some of the faculty members and their impact on you and on the school?
Yeah, as I look back, one of the first adjectives I suppose I'd recall would be that they were a caring bunch. They just cared a lot about the pupils, the students. Of course, that wasn't so difficult then. There were only about 500, and they knew everybody. I knew everybody and here, all the students and all the faculty at that time. But I think in addition to being caring, they were very competent. They were knowledgeable people, and they were they had a sense of humor and related well to people. There wasn't any nonsense. There was business atmosphere. There was a job to be done. So I think all of their characteristics were very good to get to have me feel good about my experience here at Morehead State.
Would you care to mention some of them specifically and
sure.
Their impact?
Well, I mentioned Dr. Lura.
Mm-hmm.
I think because he met my particular needs perhaps as well as anybody, I must think of him about number one. Dan Preston, of course, he was one who reached out in the community with his Amphion Chorus and his directing of church choirs, and through him I got a chance to get acquainted with community people and what the community was like. I sang in several church choirs in the community because he directed them. He was a man of great care, great humor. All of these teachers had a capacity that I think is commendable, that they were personal, but they had the ability to establish a distance between themselves and the students that I think was always proper, which worked out very favorably. And there's Dr. Murray, of course, who was a quiet individual who identifies so strongly with Morehead State even today, but also involved himself in the community very actively. I can remember taking my French from Virginia Fitzmaurice, and then she married Mr. Grantham. She was just like a kind of a mother hen. These kids who took French just could go to her with almost any problem or pleasure, and she would have time to listen. There was Flora Frick, who provided a different dimension. She had all the men and all the women in her classes, and she was direct and sometimes kind of startled the kids. I noticed she used to refer to them when they gave her some stupid answers. She'd say, she used the word infants. And some of the kids didn't know quite how to handle that, but Flora Frick had a profound impact on these people. I mentioned Christensen, who was in the education department. He had a doctorate degree in education, but he conducted the band. It wasn't as specialized then as it is now. He was also closely identified with fraternities and some of the other groups. Sliv Nemzik, of course, was a great person who attracted a lot of people and provided a lot of color for college. Those are some of the people that I recall with great pleasure and pride, but I felt good about all of them. Really, they were just a great bunch of people.
Earlier, you were talking a little about Caswell Ballard. Do you remember much about him?
I'm sure most people mention him. He was a rather formal type of teacher who taught biology. Unlike any of the others, he would have his recitation sessions consist of direct questions by him, and in response the people would stand, and he would kind of grill them. It was interesting. Sometimes some of the kids tried to fake it, and he would lead them on them in that path that they had started. And he was very clever. He sobered people in a hurry in their discussions in his class. He was a He was a respected person, maybe feared a bit, but he knew his business.
It's interesting, the people that you've just been talking about, five of them have buildings named after mm-hmm. them. Ballard, Frick, Murray, Grantham, and Nimzik. And Dr. Lura, not too long ago, retired as the president of Minot
exactly.
State
mm-hmm.
out in North Dakota. One of the things that happened, I believe it was once a week, was during your period here, was called chapel hour. Could you elaborate on chapel hour for us?
Well, I think the one single most important contribution of chapel was not perhaps the inspiration from the messages or the profound utterances of speakers there, but it was the feeling of security that we had when we went over there. I think we must recall that 40 years ago, you know, most of us were from the rural country. We came with a lot of trepidation. We didn't have many outside experiences before we went to college. Most of us came from small high schools. While some people sputtered about it, it nevertheless was a time when people got together, the whole student body came, attendance was taken. But there was a feeling, an indirect feeling, that these people do care. And I, at least in retrospect, I have a very positive feeling about that. It just helped me bridge that gap that I had stepping from the rural environment here to a rather fast-moving college situation.
Now, chapel hour and messages would infer to someone today things of a religious nature. Were these religious messages at that time?
At certain times in the season, like holidays. But for the most part, they started with a reading of scripture, and but then they were usually secular messages, speeches. Maybe somebody was visiting in the community or had visited the college. They were the local business people, leaders, clergymen, and so on, who addressed the student body at that time.
Who was the president of the college at that
McLean.
Time? McLean. Did he participate in these chapel hours?
Oh, yes. He was there every time. He read the scripture.
Oh, he did.
He was the boss.
Oh, I see.
He presided.
All right. You mentioned some of the student organizations. You talked a little about social functions and so on. But what type of music organizations did we have on campus at that time?
Essentially, three. The band, the choir, and a ladies' group called Euterpe. Maud Wink had the Euterpe group. She was in the music department. Dan Preston had the choir. And the choir sang for chapel, incidentally, or every time. Mm-hmm. At least sang responses and introits and so on. And then the band played not very often. They paraded at homecoming time and played for football games. And I think I'd like to comment about the quality of the musical groups at that time. It's if I might, this is subjective analysis, of course, but I can't help but feel that the people who directed these groups at that time should have had about double salary, because they really had subs all the way through. The kids, you know, like myself, who came here, we had an interest in things, in music and art and athletics and so on, but we didn't have much finesse or experience. And I'm sure that this must have been very trying for some of the music leaders and the Slid Nemzik and some of the coaches to try to put a group out in front of the public with the type of talent that we had. I'm sure that today There are a number of high schools that could equal or surpass the quality of performance that we had at that time. At least it, as we assembled in the fall, it was pretty raw.
Could you describe graduation in 1939 for us?
It was a formal event. It was one that was a, really a highlight. It was respected. The kids looked forward to it with great anticipation. I can remember we had, long before graduation time, of course, we planned our announcements. We'd send out formal announcements. We had rings, and we invited a certain number of people, important people, to attend our graduation exercises. I'm sure a lot of these are similar today, but there was a formality then that was just a little bit different than it is today.
What kind of activities took place? Like, did you was there a baccalaureate at that time, or did the graduation start in the morning? Was there a parade for graduation?
Well, there was baccalaureate, and the graduation was in the daytime, and that's a few years ago. I can't remember all the details, but I know it was a pleasant experience for me, even though it was a hot one. It was a hot day, as they usually are in June at that time.
How many people graduated in your class? Do you remember?
No, I don't. I think it is about 145.
I suppose it was in Weld Hall.
Yeah, right.
Well, since you graduated in 1939, Riney, what kind of contacts have you had with Morehead State?
Well, I've been a member of the Alumni Association. I've tried to be in touch there. I've been in contact a number of times with the development department. Probably most frequently, though, I've been in touch with the education department, because I was in education, and I was happy to have been a part of that process when I suppose we always had about 10 or 15 students who were going into education who were student teachers at our school where I was. And so I spent a lot of time with the kids and tried to give them some assists in their effort to become good teachers. And in that process, of course, I met a lot of the men and ladies from the education department. And so I always kept in contact with the university all the time, every year.
I know you were a principal at Morehead North for many years. What other schools were you in after you left Morehead State?
Well, my first job was at Ulin, Minnesota. And I got that job because I took part in an operetta. And the superintendent was looking around. Maybe I could say he was on the prowl for somebody who could teach music and about 14 other subjects. Well, he was in attendance that one night of one of the performances, and wouldn't you know, I got a job offer, and I think I got $115, and I think that was the second highest paying job at that time. And if I might just add what I taught.
Let me ask about the $115. That's per month?
Per month, yes.
Okay, what did you teach?
Well, I had my broad majors and minors, and I suppose that helped with certification there, but at that time, they didn't just limit it to the areas of certification. I can remember, well, I had a social studies major, but I sure didn't have commercial law as one of my courses that I in the college. That was one of the courses I taught. I taught economic geography. I taught general business. I taught two classes in English. I was a junior high school principal. I had all the vocal classes. And then the band. And of course that meant if you're going to have a band, you had to give individual lessons and group lessons, and that meant starting at 8 o'clock in the morning and going right on until 6 o'clock at night. And then in the evening we'd go home kind of tired, but I was younger then and I could handle it a bit better. But I can remember doing a lot of study, especially on things like commercial law or some of the things that I hadn't had before. But those were the days of teaching at that time.
Where did you go after you were at Yulin?
I went to Bemidji. Then the war came along, my education was interrupted that for a while, and then I started in again, and then I took my advanced work in counseling and administration. I had a degree in both areas. And then a job opened up here in Moorhead, and I thought, well, my memories of Moorhead are pretty good, and my wife was a graduate from this college, university, and knew the area pretty well, so we both agreed that this might be a good spot to come back to, and the job was offered to us, and we did, came back, and we've been here ever since, and we're pleased with that decision.
All righty, we've gone through your career at Moorhead State pretty well. You know, this is an oral history project, and people in the future, down the line, will be listening to this and trying to put together pieces of various kinds. Is there any particular thing you'd like to leave with these people 15, 20, or 30 years down the road?
I think the example of being exemplary educators or models, by the faculty when I was here, is probably the most important single lesson that I observed or learned, or the one that I appreciate most. I know we have moved into mechanized businesses, and some people call dehumanized activities, but more and more I appreciate, and I also feel that in the future the people who are concerned about their fellow man and about their co-workers are still going to be the happiest people, because it's that human element that really helps me to enjoy my life more completely. And I think that will never change. And I hope that as they look forward to their careers, that they will keep in mind that aspect of their work has to be fostered and perpetuated and considered, because unless there's job satisfaction, there isn't, the life isn't as full as it could be. And mine has been a great full life, and I've enjoyed it, and I think Moorhead State has contributed a lot to that.
You've described the Moorhead State faculty during your period here as caring and competent, and I know when you had an opportunity to build your own faculty at North, you did the same thing. I want to thank you for coming in today.
It's been my pleasure.